Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Sam.
And I'm Sean.
And this is Key to the Case. Welcome back. Thank you all so much for listening today. And thank you to our listener, Carol, for recommending today's case. All right, let's dive in. Michelle Malama Witherall was 24 years old at the time of her death in 1992. Michelle was raised in Parker, Colorado, a town located about a 30-minute drive outside of Denver by her parents, Kathy and Everett, alongside her two brothers, Rhett and Todd. From a young age, Michelle had a love for animals. At just 9 years old, she joined 4-H, where she raised sheep and showed Arabian horses. Michelle was known for her joyful spirit and loving nature, someone you felt lucky to know. After graduating from high school, Michelle worked diligently to become a licensed real estate agent, following in the footsteps of her parents who had built successful careers in real estate. Her father started in the field and eventually her mother joined him in the business. So Michelle had a bright and promising future ahead of her. Michelle met a man named Jeremy Witherall in Colorado, though the exact circumstances of how they met are unclear, but they dated for about a year before they married in September 1992, just a few months before Michelle's death. Shortly after the wedding, the couple relocated to Monroeville, Pennsylvania, not too far outside of Pittsburgh, after Jeremy received a job opportunity through his brother. His brother was launching a weekly newspaper, and Jeremy accepted a position as an account executive. Unfortunately, Michelle and Jeremy's marriage faced difficulties early on. According to those closest to Michelle, the couple argued frequently, and their disagreements often became rather heated. Michelle confided in friends about Jeremy's verbal abuse and his apparent jealous nature. During Investigation Discovery's Crime Scene Confidential coverage of this case, Michelle's best friend recalled how Michelle described Jeremy as controlling, demeaning, and isolating. There was one incident in particular that raised concern. Michelle's friend noticed bruising on her leg and asked her about it. Michelle initially deflected, saying she would explain later. But when later came around, Michelle explained that Jeremy had pushed her, her leg hit a table, and Michelle blamed herself for the injury. Michelle's friend even said that Jeremy only allowed her to exercise at their apartment complex in the hallways. If true, that is deeply isolating and controlling behavior. Sadly, there was nothing I read about Michelle and Jeremy's relationship that seemed healthy or positive. As is detailed in Crime Scene Confidential, Michelle would often leave notes for and about Jeremy on the refrigerator and throughout their home. One note said, "You're being mean. Be nicer." Another note read, "Michelle's bitch list." And this was a note that Michelle wrote out that seemed to outline issues in their relationship. Part of the list read, "Not acting as interested in me or us as you used to." Following that read, "Don't seem committed," "Mean mouth," "Not close enough." And it went on. This is clearly troubling, but it's especially troubling considering they were newlyweds. This is just the beginning for them. It wasn't only Michelle's friends and family who knew about the concerning nature of her relationship with Jeremy. Neighbors at the couple's Monroeville apartment also recalled repeated loud arguments between them. One neighbor who lived directly below Michelle and Jeremy reported hearing frequent yelling and banging coming from their unit during November and December of 1992. The neighbor eventually submitted a complaint to the property manager, and a couple of weeks before Michelle's death, this tenant told the property manager someone is going to be killed in that apartment.
Yeah, the yelling and the commotion must have been really intense to make such an extreme statement.
I agree. I think that speaks to how bad this had gotten, if she's saying that. And this neighbor had even started taking certain sleep medication so she could sleep through some of the commotion going on up there. And when the neighbor brought this to the property manager, he did speak with Jeremy, but Jeremy basically said, this is paraphrasing here, but it's not his business, right? They could handle it between themselves. According to Michelle's parents, Michelle had spoken with her mother on the phone the day she died. During that conversation, Michelle said she had a lot she needed to talk about with both of her parents. She told her mother that she didn't believe it was God's will for her to stay in the abusive situation she was in, hinting that she was seriously considering a divorce or separation from Jeremy. The couple had plans to travel back to Colorado for the upcoming holidays, but Michelle expressed a desire to return even earlier than originally planned. I suspect this was all very difficult for Michelle, who had actually previously been married in Colorado for 2.5-3 years, a marriage that, according to Michelle's mom, ended when he became verbally abusive. On Michelle and Jeremy's wedding day, friends and family reported that Michelle expressed feelings of regret. I mean, I can't think of a worse way to start your marriage. Just a few months into their marriage, Michelle and Jeremy spent the evening of December 19th, 1992, out for dinner and drinks at a local restaurant. But according to Jeremy's own account, the night took a turn when he made an inappropriate comment about a woman wearing a Hooters t-shirt. Jeremy didn't recall exactly what he said, but it sounded like it was some sort of off-color comment. Michelle was upset by the remark, and the two began to argue. Some reports state they also argued that night about how Michelle was growing tired of how demanding Jeremy's new job was. If they didn't discuss that topic that night, they had in the past, but some say that that was part of the conversation too. They bought beer on their way back, and once they got home, Michelle chose to stay in the car alone for a while, and Jeremy went upstairs to the apartment. Now, this wasn't unusual for Michelle. Several neighbors later recounted seeing Michelle sit alone in the car like this on more than one occasion. I assume this was just to get space from Jeremy. They could both cool down. They lived in a one-bedroom apartment, so there's not a lot of space in a one-bedroom apartment to separate from the person you're in an argument with. According to Jeremy, he was in the living room playing solitaire when Michelle eventually came up to the apartment from the car, questioned Jeremy about the woman from the restaurant, but he ignored her. She cracked open a beer and then walked out to their third floor balcony. The couch Jeremy was sitting on was right next to the balcony door, a balcony door that had no curtains or other window treatments. Not long after, he said he heard a noise. It was a thud or something similar. He wasn't exactly sure what he heard, but it was enough to make him get up and check. When he stepped out onto the balcony and looked over the railing, he saw Michelle lying on the grass below. Blood had started to pool around her head, and realizing the severity of what he was seeing, Jeremy grabbed his phone, called 911, and ran down the stairs to be with her. Now, something interesting is that during the 911 call, Jeremy said at one point that his wife had jumped off the balcony. It's a very specific word, jump. Maybe it was a poor choice in this intense moment, but jump implies intent. And by Jeremy's account, he did not witness Michelle go over the railing. So you might think the default assumption would be that she accidentally fell rather than jumped. This was about a 33-foot or 10-meter drop. We're talking three stories here. And Michelle sustained severe injuries, which we'll get into later because they play a major role in this case. But while Jeremy was on the phone with emergency services, he said he tried to give her mouth to mouth and clear her airway. And that's when he realized Michelle was still breathing. First responders arrived at the scene around 12:45 a.m. and Michelle was rushed to an area hospital, which is good because she could then receive the medical care she needed. But it meant that by the time the investigators arrived, they didn't get to see Michelle in the position she was in when Jeremy was attempting to save her life. And it also meant that the scene was compromised. She was still unconscious when she arrived, and despite the medical team's efforts, she was pronounced dead approximately 14 hours later. Michelle's parents were quickly notified and managed to make it to Pennsylvania before she died. Michelle's father shared a deeply emotional memory from those final hours. When Michelle was in a coma, he held her hand and she squeezed his. When you watch him tell that story, you can tell that's a moment he has held on to since it happened, and her parents saw it as Michelle saying goodbye. Michelle's family reported that Jeremy gave multiple versions of what happened that night. The first was that he heard a noise, walked out to the balcony, and saw Michelle on the ground below. The initial version I gave you. Another version came to Michelle's family from Jeremy's mom. She claimed he said that Michelle had been hanging Christmas lights on the balcony and accidentally fell. And in yet another account, Jeremy said Michelle was hanging from the balcony and he tried to pull her up, but she lost her grip and fell. Now, to be clear, Jeremy denies ever changing his story. He insists he only gave one version of events, the first version.
So Jeremy himself only ever gave the first account of events, right? And the other two came from people who said Jeremy told them a different account of events.
Not necessarily, because the third one where he says she was hanging from the balcony and he tried to pull her up, my understanding is that came directly from Jeremy to her family. The second version with the Christmas lights, that's the one that sounded like it came from Jeremy's mom to Michelle's family, but originated from Jeremy, according to them. So are we to believe that Michelle's family is lying or misremembering? Because that's what's implied if Jeremy is saying he only told one story, right? And why would they make these stories up? So if you're Michelle's family and you're hearing these different explanations, you can understand how that would be deeply unsettling. It's one thing to get a few details mixed up in the midst of a traumatic event. That's completely understandable. But entirely different scenarios, especially one in which Michelle was hanging from the balcony and he couldn't help her up. I mean, that's completely different than not seeing anything happen.
Yeah, and the detail about hanging Christmas lights, that's a very memorable detail in the storyline. That's something that would at least stick out to me, and that's something I would remember if that's the story I was told.
Yeah, I don't think you're just going to insert Christmas lights into your memory without that coming to you. And I, as far as I could find, there were no Christmas lights hanging from the balcony or anything like that. And Michelle's family in particular found the accidental fall explanation hard to believe. The balcony railing was about 4 feet high, which was pretty much chest level for Michelle. Falling over that accidentally without climbing or leaning far over would be difficult. The most likely accidental fall situation seemed to be if she sat or stood on the railing for some reason and lost her balance.
Yeah, and the railing wasn't broken or anything, right? She wasn't leaning against the railing and it snapped or something.
No, this balcony was like a solid wall. So this was certainly not a situation where Michelle accidentally went over because of a faulty balcony. Now, there was a little bit of damage to the top of it. it looked like a small chunk had been taken out, but that aligned with Michelle going over the ledge and knocking a small chunk of this balcony out on her way. Early on in the investigation, the Monroeville Police Department decided to call in the Allegheny County Police. It seemed this type of case was beyond what the local department typically handled. When the investigators arrived at the scene, they made a few observations that immediately raised eyebrows. One of Michelle's shoes was found 26 feet or 8 meters from her body. The other shoe, never found. The one that was recovered was described as a ballet flat, something that usually fits snugly on the foot. Now, I get that she allegedly fell from a great height, and sure, it's possible for a shoe to come off and that kind of impact. But for it to land 26 feet away, it's a little surprising, but I suppose not impossible. But these shoes are sort of a mystery on their own. And surely Michelle wasn't wearing one shoe when she went out to the balcony. So the fact that they were never able to find the other shoe could imply another person's involvement here. But why? What significance would the shoes hold? It almost seems as though if Jeremy had something to do with this, he threw one of the shoes over the balcony and forgot about the other one or couldn't find the other one, but they've never been able to determine what went on with the shoes. The investigators also noted that the apartment's front door had two locks and both were locked when they arrived. This suggested that Jeremy had taken the time to lock the door after discovering Michelle on the ground below. They observed that the sliding balcony door was nearly closed and there was some damage to the door, although the specifics are unclear. So this is not damning information by any means, but they certainly noted these details. The state of the apartment didn't suggest that a struggle had taken place. There was no visible blood inside the apartment or on the balcony, and nothing appeared to be broken or overturned in a way that would indicate violence. That said, the apartment was generally unkempt. I've seen photos of the scene and it looked fairly messy, cluttered, drawers open, clothes left out, and various items scattered around, but nothing stood out to the investigators as suspicious. As I mentioned earlier, Jeremy said Michelle had taken a beer with her out to the balcony, and they did find an open can of beer sitting on top of a box out there. It was nearly full, which aligns with Jeremy saying this incident occurred shortly after she stepped out on the balcony. Inside the apartment, a deck of cards was laid out on the coffee table in a way consistent with someone playing solitaire, which also aligns with Jeremy's statement that he was playing at the time. The investigators interviewed the neighbors to find out if anyone had seen or heard anything of interest that night. The same neighbor we mentioned earlier, the one who lived directly below Michelle and Jeremy, reported hearing a loud, thumping, two-hour-long argument around 10 or 11 p.m. It was intense enough that it shook her chandelier. Shortly after her chandelier shook, she heard a louder thud. She claimed most of the yelling came from Jeremy, but she couldn't make out what was being said. After the louder thud, she began hearing the balcony door open and close about 5 times. And keep in mind, this was December in Pennsylvania. It wasn't exactly the kind of night you'd expect someone to be going in and out onto the balcony multiple times. And Jeremy didn't mention that he or Michelle went out onto the balcony numerous times. Jeremy did acknowledge that he and Michelle argued on the way home from the restaurant, but according to him, once they got back to the apartment, they didn't engage further. But then why the repeated balcony door activity? As far as I could find, there was no clear explanation offered for that. Now, to play devil's advocate, it's possible the neighbor misremembered the date she heard all this noise. Given how often Michelle and Jeremy reportedly fought, maybe she confused that night with another, but still, this was the night Michelle died. You'd think that would make it more memorable.
Yeah, the neighbor's comments a few weeks ago seemed somewhat hyperbolic at the time, saying someone's going to get killed in that apartment, but knowing what we know now, that it was actually pretty accurate.
Yeah, she wasn't too far off. I mean, we don't know if Michelle was killed, but she died and something horrible happened. So yeah, it gives this neighbor's comments more credence. Michelle's autopsy was completed shortly after her death. The autopsy revealed that Michelle's jaw was broken, her left femur was fractured, both of her wrists were fractured. She had multiple skull fractures that were more concentrated on the left side of her head, and she had various abrasions and contusions on her body.
Were all these injuries attributed to the fall itself?
That's going to be a huge discussion in this because most of the injuries seem consistent with the fall, but there will be experts who argue that her head injuries were not. And I will say Michelle was found lying on her left side. So the injuries to the left side of her body did seem consistent with how she was found. A sample of Michelle's blood was taken when she got to the hospital. And when it was tested, it was determined that her blood alcohol concentration was in the 0.19 to 0.20 range. Now, BAC can change after someone's death. The sooner the sample is taken, the better. But because this was taken when Michelle was still in the hospital and we know she was alive for half a day, this should be a pretty accurate reading. At this level of intoxication, a person will typically lose their balance, are more likely to feel nauseated, slur their words, and feelings of pain may be numbed. Dr. John Heiserat was the pathologist who conducted this autopsy, and he ruled Michelle's manner of death as undetermined. A number of people in this case have expressed confusion that although Michelle sustained head injuries and a broken jaw, there was no damage to her teeth or nose. I can see her nose maybe not being broken if she landed on her left side, but it's hard to wrap your head around the lack of damage to Michelle's teeth. Another oddity was the fact that her palms were undamaged with no scrapes or abrasions. They were clean. So Michelle's wrists being fractured would make sense if she tried to break her fall, but you'd probably expect there to be some indication of this on her palms. Michelle also had no internal bruising or internal organ damage or a pelvic fracture, as you would expect from a fall like this. However, Michelle reportedly landed on the grass or mostly on the grass below the balcony, and that could have affected her injuries, softening the landing a bit. Michelle's jeans had a tar-like streak on the back of her right leg in the mid-thigh area. That streak was bisected by a small tear in her jeans, which supports the notion that Michelle went over the balcony. That motion could have snagged her jeans.
So I can personally relate to this case in regard to the fall from the balcony. I actually, and you know this, but for the listeners, I fell from a three-story building, and the only injury I sustained was a broken jaw and some pretty significant teeth fractures. So I'm kind of surprised that she did break her jaw and didn't have any fractures in her teeth or any, you know, chipped or broken teeth. But at the same time, she endured a lot of other injuries that I didn't have happen to me, including, you know, the wrist fractures and, you know, the long list of other injuries that she had. And, you know, the situations were kind of different. There was a structure that kind of broke my fall on the way down. And that's what I think actually broke my jaw. I didn't fall straight from the third story to the grass as Michelle did in this case. There was a structure about that was one story tall that did break my fall. But yeah, I didn't have any other injuries. I didn't fracture my wrists or
my skull
or
your leg.
Yeah, legs or anything like that. It was just the jaw and the teeth.
And you were not immediately rendered unconscious, right?
Yeah. I got back, I kind of popped right back up and walked back up to the third story. And that's when paramedics were called.
Right. And I did think about this incident, of course, as I was researching this case. And obviously, it was a very traumatic incident. But so much of this case hinges on Michelle's injuries. So I think by sharing that example, of course, you and Michelle didn't experience the exact same situation, but there are a lot of similarities. And it goes to show that you can have different injuries and it's not an exact science. So as we continue on in the case and talk about all the different experts who weigh in, you have to keep that in mind, that the ones who say, well, this is what we'd expect to see, this is what we say, like, yes, there are circumstances that typically happen, but there's variability always. According to the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Michelle's family was deeply unsatisfied with the official ruling that her manner of death was undetermined. From the beginning, they were suspicious, and as time passed with little progress in the investigation, they decided to take matters into their own hands. In 1994, using funds from their successful real estate business, they launched a privately funded investigation. They hired two different independent forensic pathologists to review Michelle's autopsy and the surrounding circumstances, and both experts came to the same opinion. Michelle's injuries were more consistent with a physical beating than a fall. They noted that the level of head trauma expected from a three-story drop simply wasn't there. The family also requested that renowned forensic pathologist Dr. Cyril Wecht review the case. At the time, Dr. Wecht was not serving as the Allegheny County coroner as he once had, but after being reelected to the position, he initiated a formal coroner's inquest to re-examine Michelle's death. Some of you might recognize his name. Dr. Wecht passed away last year, but during his lifetime, he was one of the most prominent and outspoken forensic pathologists in the country. He consulted on many high-profile cases, including the JFK assassination and JonBenet Ramsey. In fact, he even weighed in on the not-as-high-profile case of Sean Drenth, which we discussed a couple episodes back. While he could be considered controversial in some ways, there's no denying he was an experienced and well-respected expert in his field. Michelle's parents also hired a private investigator to assist, as the Allegheny County Police believed there was little to investigate. After interviewing witnesses and Jeremy, who reportedly passed two polygraph tests, the police took little action. County officials told Michelle's family that they couldn't proceed unless the original coroner, Dr. Heiserat, revised his initial determination of the manner of death. In 1997, the family requested that Dr. Heiserat re-examined the case. He agreed and ultimately reversed his opinion, concluding that Michelle's death was a homicide caused by blunt force trauma. He said the injuries to her head were more severe than you would expect from a three-story fall, which doesn't exactly align with what the other experts were saying. He backpedaled shortly after, saying her death could have been the result of a fall. It seemed like he wasn't willing to commit to the homicide caused by blunt force trauma theory. It seemed that he was leaving the door open for this being an accidental fall. After the coroner's inquest and further investigation, 7 years to the day after Michelle's death, on December 20th, 1999, Jeremy was charged with third-degree murder and involuntary manslaughter. Prosecutors will sometimes bring multiple charges stemming from the same incident, known as alternative or lesser included charges, to provide the jury with different options. That way, if the jury isn't fully convinced of the more serious charge, third degree murder in this case, they still have the option to convict on the lesser charge of involuntary manslaughter. It may seem like these charges came out of nowhere, but as we get into the trial, which began in January 2001, you'll understand the case against Jeremy better. The prosecution's case, in a nutshell, was that the evening's turmoil began at the restaurant where Jeremy made the comment that upset Michelle. They asserted that the fighting continued and Jeremy crushed Michelle's skull in a drunken fight at the apartment. He then pushed his potentially unconscious wife over the balcony, causing more injuries to her body. They suggested that Michelle's death could have been related to the phone call she had earlier in the day with her mom, where she indicated she was thinking about leaving Jeremy. Did he overhear that phone call? Or maybe Michelle even brought this up to him. We don't know, but it's possible that this topic came up. Dr. Weck testified that Michelle's main cause of death was a blow to her head from a blunt object. According to the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, he said, quote, "It was the absence of injuries that made her death suspicious. Because Michelle Witherall's left cheekbone was not broken, it suggested that other nearby injuries to her jaw and skull did not occur as a result of the fall," end quote. While he acknowledged that most of her injuries were consistent with a fall from that height, the nature of her skull fractures raised some concerns. He stated that in a fall where this is the type of skull fracture, there should be damage to the brain on the other side of the head opposite of the skull fracture, or a contra coup injury. She had the coup injury, the forward motion injury, but not the contra coup injury. These injuries most commonly occur when a person's head hits a fixed surface with force. The ground, in this case, would have been the fixed surface. This led Dr. Wecht to conclude that the skull fractures were more likely caused by a blow to the head before the fall rather than from the fall itself. So the assertion is that Michelle was hit by a blunt object before going over the balcony, meaning she either didn't hit her head when she hit the ground, or she did, but that's not what caused the injuries. Wecht also put forth that Michelle's fractured wrists could have been a result of Jeremy's actions, something he caused intentionally rather than from Michelle trying to break a fall. In 1996, Michelle's case was featured on Unsolved Mysteries. Dr. Wecht appeared in the episode and made a striking claim. He stated that Michelle's body had been found 9 feet away from the apartment building. That kind of distance would raise serious questions. How could someone simply fall and land that far out? During the interview, Dr. Wecht said, "If I had to pick one singular physical factor in this case that leads me to the conclusion that it was not an accidental fall or suicidal fall, it would be that." But during the trial, it was revealed that this statement was inaccurate. Michelle's body was not found 9 feet from the wall. It was only about 3.5 or 4 feet away.
When you say the wall, do you mean like the physical wall of the building, or like the plane on the edge of the balcony where it extends out? Because if the balcony is like 4 to 5 feet, then that would be consistent with about 9 feet from the wall. But you know, if he was asserting that she was 9 feet away from the edge of the balcony, then yeah, that would be more inconsistent.
That raises an interesting point. So I should have clarified this, but he was talking about from the end of the balcony. So 9 feet from the farthest point out from the building. So that wouldn't make sense in an accidental fall. But he said that he based that on the findings of others. So now I'm wondering if maybe someone measured from the actual wall to where they estimated Michelle was, because it's not perfect since we know that she was moved very quickly. But if they measured from the wall to where they think she was, that would have included the balcony. So that could actually make sense as to where the 9 feet came from. And then maybe Dr. Wecht misunderstood that, because he testified, he said on the stand that he was incorrect in his statement on Unsolved Mysteries.
Yeah, that inconsistency works heavily in favor of the defense, because he said the distance away from the wall was the most compelling piece of evidence, right? That it wasn't a fall?
Right. He said if he had to pick one piece of physical evidence that supported that this was not an accidental fall, it would be that. So the defense was able to use that misstatement to challenge the credibility of his conclusions. The prosecution presented several witnesses, one of them being a man named Jeffrey, who was an old friend of Jeremy's from Denver. After Michelle's death, Jeffrey actually moved to Pennsylvania to work at the same publication as Jeremy, and even shared an apartment with him for a time after Michelle's death. According to reporting from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Jeffrey testified about an incident that took place on the one-year anniversary of Michelle's death. That day, he said Jeremy seemed especially agitated and distraught, so the pair went out for drinks. During their outing, Jeffrey recalled that Jeremy broke down and said something along the lines of, "It was a terrible thing. Things got out of hand. I'm sorry. It shouldn't have happened." Jeffrey didn't interpret this as a full confession, but it sounded like Jeremy was taking some degree of responsibility, or at least hinting at it. Jeremy told Jeffrey that Michelle accidentally fell from the balcony because the balcony had a flimsy railing and it broke away when she leaned against it, which is not true. And this goes back to what you asked earlier about this balcony. The balcony was not broken apart, and it was more than a foot thick. When Jeffrey saw images of this balcony at Jeremy's attorney's office, he saw it was nothing like Jeremy described. After that night, Jeffrey began distancing himself from Jeremy. He testified that in the months that followed, he grew frustrated with Jeremy's unpredictable mood swings and angry outbursts. And he felt used both by Jeremy and Jeremy's brother, who ran the publication where they worked. So by the spring of 1994, Jeffrey had moved back to Denver. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reported that Jeffrey came forward with this information years before charges were ever filed. And at the time, it was one of the first significant pieces of evidence that pointed toward Jeremy's potential involvement. Several neighbors testified to witnessing frequent arguments between Jeremy and Michelle. One neighbor described Jeremy as having a visibly bad temper, even recalling an incident where they saw him aggressively kicking his car in the parking lot of the apartment complex. And if your neighbors know you have a bad temper, I feel like that's a pretty bad sign, because that's what's displayed outwardly. And in most cases, it is worse behind closed doors. A woman named Susan testified that she and her husband met Michelle and Jeremy on a honeymoon cruise just 2 months before Michelle's death. Susan and Michelle quickly became close, and during a private moment, Michelle confided, though somewhat indirectly, that Jeremy had been physically abusive. She even showed Susan bruises that she claimed were from him. At one point during the trip, Susan called Michelle and Jeremy's cabin to invite them to breakfast. According to Susan, that simple gesture sent Jeremy into a rage. He didn't like how quickly Michelle had bonded with her. The next day, Susan's husband stopped by their room and found it to be in disarray. There was broken glass on the floor and the phone had been ripped from the wall. Susan testified that Michelle told them Jeremy had trashed the room in anger over her new friendship with Susan. Having multiple independent witnesses, not just Michelle's family and friends, detailing Jeremy's apparent abuse is powerful for the prosecution. These people have no stake in the outcome of Jeremy's trial, right? They're just sharing what they know, and it paints Jeremy in a concerning light. Lastly, the prosecution took the unusual step of criticizing aspects of the initial investigation, something more commonly expected from the defense. During cross-examination, they questioned Allegheny County homicide detective Gary Talent, who had been the lead investigator at the scene. The prosecution portrayed the investigation as lacking in thoroughness and attention to detail. For instance, the area where Michelle's body was found was not properly secured or covered. Detective Talent explained that by the time they arrived, freezing rain had already fallen heavily, likely washing away any trace evidence. Additionally, the prosecution highlighted that a forensic crime unit was never called to the apartment to search for potential trace evidence. Talent responded that because Michelle and Jeremy lived in the apartment, he believed any scene integrity had already been compromised. And I think the point, I guess, he was trying to make was that there was no other viable suspect who could have been behind this. No one else was there with Michelle and Jeremy that night. The prosecution used these oversights to suggest that potentially critical evidence may have been lost or never collected. And on that note, the top of the balcony at Michelle and Jeremy's apartment was deteriorating a little bit. Like we talked about before, it was this crumbling stucco material. So if Michelle had gone over the ledge, it would have been reasonable to expect that some fragments or trace material from the balcony would have been found on her clothing, but no such evidence was recovered. That said, it was a cold, rainy night, and she was moved from that location to the hospital, not in such a way that would preserve evidence. So again, it is possible that any trace evidence was washed away or removed before it could be collected. Now, the defense's position and explanation of Michelle's death was that she died from an accidental fall from the balcony. They brought forth a couple of forensic experts to support this, including medical examiner Dr. Warner Spitz, another well-known forensic pathologist who testified that Michelle's head struck the ground on the left side, leading to the skull fractures and bruising on the upper left portion of her brain. He further explained that she sustained additional head injuries as the energy from the initial impact dissipated. Dr. Spitz disagreed with Dr. Weck's conclusion about the absence of a contra coup injury, contending instead that the lack of such an injury actually supported his opinion that the injuries were caused by a fall. The second expert, Dr. Mary Case, a forensic neuropathologist and medical examiner based in St. Louis, corroborated Dr. Spitz's assessment. She testified that, in her opinion, Michelle's injuries were consistent with the fall, with the exception of one laceration on the posterior of her leg. Dr. Case also addressed the lack of injuries to Michelle's palms, suggesting it was possible that Michelle did not attempt to break her fall with her hands. But her most important point, in my opinion, is that she said, during a fall from a great height, 15 feet or more, you lose the contra coup injury that we've talked about. She explained, that kind of injury would be more common in someone who falls from a lower height. So according to her, it is not proof of a previous head injury. And she said, even in a fall from a lower height, you'd expect to see the contra coup injury in about 85% of instances, not 100%. During cross-examination, the prosecution challenged her conclusions by noting that her report omitted mention of Michelle's broken jaw and that she had not reviewed all available evidence, including x-rays. Ultimately, the case became a classic battle of the experts. For the jury, this must have been incredibly difficult to navigate, presented a real challenge for the average juror, someone without specialized medical knowledge, to assess conflicting expert testimony of the nature of Michelle's injuries and what they indicate. When multiple experts offer opposing interpretations of the same evidence, how is a layperson supposed to determine which version is more credible?
Did any of the experts touch on if her level of intoxication could have affected or, you know, changed the determination of her injuries, whether it was the fall or blunt force trauma? Or
they did talk about Michelle's level of intoxication. The defense called Dr. Charles Winnick. He was the former head of the county crime lab. He testified about her level of intoxication, which, as you might recall, was a BAC around 0.19 to 0.20. He explained that at this level, Michelle's vision would have been significantly impaired. Objects could have appeared farther away than they actually were. He testified that her motor skills would have been compromised, affecting her coordination and balance. So they didn't necessarily talk about how that would have affected her injuries, but it was still critical testimony for the defense because it supported their argument that Michelle's fall was a tragic accident influenced by her level of intoxication, right? It's a variable. It matters in the sense that it could have made it more likely that Michelle accidentally fell. I think the accidental fall theory would be harder to sell if Michelle were completely sober. That would be very hard to believe that she could just accidentally fall over this balcony. So I don't really think her level of intoxication related to her injuries. except for maybe her trying to break her fall or not trying to break her fall. We don't know. I think in your situation, I know you didn't try to break your fall when you fell from the third story, and that actually reduced the number of injuries you received based on what the medical staff told you. So yeah, in this case, we don't really know if it played a role at all. The defense also pointed to the absence of any signs of a struggle in the apartment as a key element in refuting the prosecution's case. Their argument was that if a violent altercation had taken place, especially one in which Jeremy allegedly struck Michelle in the head, there would likely have been visible evidence, such as disarray or blood at the scene. The lack of such indicators, they argued, undermined the theory of a physical confrontation leading to Michelle's death.
So I'm assuming Jeremy didn't have any injuries himself.
Right. He didn't have injuries on his body that would have indicated he and Michelle got into a fight. Which, if this was an ongoing issue, if there was physical violence against Michelle in their relationship, I don't necessarily think you would expect Jeremy to have injuries. Maybe if this were a first-time incident, or if taking it out of the context of Michelle and Jeremy, if you think about cases we've covered where the person was most likely murdered by a stranger and the person, their family and friends thought they would fight back. Okay, in that scenario, it would probably be stranger if the person didn't have injuries. So it was up to the jurors to decide how much weight they wanted to give that specific detail. There were a couple of interesting points presented during the crime scene confidential coverage, and I'm not sure if they reported on during the trial. I would suspect they were, but it's not entirely clear. The prosecution never clearly identified a specific murder weapon, at least not in the records I could find, so I can't tell you what they believe he hit her in the head with. On Crime Scene Confidential, they reference photos of Michelle and Jeremy's apartment and point out a large glass rum bottle that was seen on the kitchen counter. It's been theorized that this bottle could have been used in an assault and may have caused the blunt force injuries to Michelle's head. At one point, it was also suggested that Michelle was beaten with a portable phone. However, there's no definitive evidence linking the bottle, phone, or any other object as the weapon used. Some have theorized, including Michelle's family's private investigator, that Michelle was struck with an object, killed, and then placed on the ground, as in carried down to that location, although this was not the prosecution's theory. One major issue with this theory is the presence of blood found beneath Michelle's head when she was discovered. Experts estimated it would have taken approximately 2 minutes for that amount of blood to accumulate, and it would have started quickly after receiving the injury. This raises a critical question. If she had been injured elsewhere and then moved, how did the blood pool so significantly at that location and nowhere else? The defense called lead investigator Gary Talent to testify that during initial interviews conducted shortly after Michelle's death, none of her family members or friends mentioned any abuse by Jeremy. The defense appeared to use this to cast doubt on the credibility of the later abuse allegations, raising the question, if abuse had occurred, why wasn't it reported from the beginning? But one could reasonably argue that in the immediate aftermath of Michelle's death, her loved ones were still reeling from the news and may have believed it was a tragic accident. It's possible they didn't initially see a need to raise concerns about Jeremy's behavior until they processed the situation. Jeremy claimed he and Michelle had typical marital issues, but denied being abusive.
There's nothing really typical about this marriage.
I know. I would say their issues are not typical or healthy. Yes, in a marriage, you expect everything's not going to be great all the time. But if we take what so many people have independently said about their marriage, yeah, I don't think these were typical issues. The trial concluded with the jury deliberating for just 2 hours before reaching a verdict. As you might expect, given the fact that we are covering this case, Jeremy was acquitted. Following the verdict, he told reporters that the jury had seen through everything and that the truth had come out. He accused Michelle's family of being consumed by an obsession, unable to accept what had happened. Of course, her family saw it as the pursuit of justice, not an obsession. While Jeremy expressed some sympathy for their loss, he maintained that the jurors had seen the situation clearly and reached the right conclusion. I found it striking that the jury deliberated for only 2 hours. In the end, so much of this case hinged on the interpretation of Michelle's injuries. It became a battle of the experts, and I don't think the prosecution presented a case strong enough to rise above reasonable doubt. Had there been no credible refutation of the claim that the absence of contrecoup injuries pointed to a blow to Michelle's head, their argument probably would have carried more weight. But I think the argument almost had to be that she was hurt before falling, because if Jeremy pushed her over the balcony, which is certainly one theory, how could you ever prove that it wasn't an accident? If you envision there being some struggle on the balcony and he pushes her over, those injuries would be very similar to those if she fell accidentally. The jury forewoman told reporters that they didn't feel as though the state had proved its case completely. They felt that maybe something had happened, but they didn't know for sure. After Jeremy was acquitted, Michelle's case was closed and deemed an accidental death.
Yeah, as much as it seemed like Jeremy was an extremely angry and abusive husband, I don't think the case was strong enough to convict him. They couldn't prove that he either pushed her or killed her before, you know, she ended up off the balcony. There just wasn't enough hard evidence, right?
Yes. And I think there are pieces of information that could have helped their case. For example, if they could prove a murder weapon in their theory, that would be huge, but they didn't. And I think as a juror, you want that kind of information, right? So they're just, I think, was too much reasonable doubt for this jury to find Jeremy guilty. And the prosecution presented some pretty compelling information. You have the neighbor who heard a fight going on that night in their apartment and the balcony door opening over and over when Jeremy did not indicate that happened. You have Michelle's family who reported Jeremy told them conflicting stories about what happened that night. You have Jeffrey, Jeremy's friend, who said he was acting distraught around the anniversary and that he indicated it was all a big mistake. Then you have Jeremy's alleged abuse. All of this is really key information. Yet for this jury, it didn't rise above the prosecution's inability to prove that Michelle died from blunt force trauma to the head and then she was thrown over the balcony. And one theory that hasn't been ruled out is suicide. I haven't spent time on this because neither side, either Michelle's side or Jeremy's side, supports this theory. But it is still a possibility considering we don't know exactly how she died. Michelle's mom has passed away, but her dad has said he holds on to the good memories with Michelle. But the outcome of the trial was deeply disappointing for them. Michelle never should have died at such a young age. Thank you all so much for tuning in this week. That is all for now, but we will be back in 2 weeks. Bye.
Bye.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.